From the WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The same communications technology that enables us to learn about the suffering of people all over the world has also led to what journalist William Shawcross calls compassion fatigue. On this edition of Fresh Air, William Shawcross talks about the have-nots of the global village, the world's 14 million refugees. Also today, we talk with actress Martha Plimpton, co-star of the new film Parenthood. At the age of 17, she's already been directed by Woody Allen, Peter Weir, Sidney Lumet, and Ron Howard. Television critic David Bianculli previews the fall season, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews an Ella Fitzgerald reissue from the early 60s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The State Department said today a plane carrying Representative Mickey Leland, congressional aides, and several other people failed to arrive as expected at a refugee camp near the Ethiopian-Sudanese border today. State Department spokeswoman Sandra McCarty says officials are trying to find out what happened to the plane.
The whereabouts of the aircraft and the party are unknown. We are concerned about the welfare of Mr. Leland and his group, and our embassy there is making every effort to locate them.
Leland is chairman of the House Select Committee on Hunger and has taken keen interest in Africa's refugees and has visited the same area in March. An FBI analysis indicates that Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins is dead. The report says a man shown hanging from a rope in a videotape sent by pro-Iranian Shiites is probably Higgins. Michael Richards has details.
President Bush called Lieutenant Colonel Higgins' wife, Robin, in mid-afternoon to express what his spokesman Marlon Fitzwater described as his support and encouragement. FBI experts say that after extensive analysis, they believe the man in the videotape is dead. And while they couldn't say for sure who he was, there are what the FBI calls numerous observable characteristics that the body in the videotape is that of Lieutenant Colonel Higgins. The FBI experts also said they couldn't say how the person died or when. The White House says diplomatic efforts are underway to try and get the body back. White House sources indicate the president has spoken to the Pope to see if the Roman Catholic Church could render any assistance. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards at the White House.
Weather conditions worsened for firefighters on the line in the West. Temperatures soared today following 12,000 lightning strikes overnight. The worst fires are concentrated in eastern Oregon and Idaho. Alan Siporn of member station KLCC reports.
Early this morning, fire officials were amazed and overjoyed when they discovered no new fires, despite thousands of lightning strikes overnight. But the good news didn't last. Fire Information Officer Sandy Socker says fires roared to life this afternoon as a result of sleeper lightning strikes.
As the day warms up, the temperatures increase, humidity drops. Those lightning strikes, those lightning sleepers will become fires.
Sometimes fires can smolder undetected for days, forcing fire detection personnel to keep a tense watch. Meanwhile, 23,000 firefighters continue to battle the hundreds of known fires scorching the West. For National Public Radio, this is Alan Siporin reporting.
A small band of anti-government students attacked the headquarters of the National Intelligence Agency today in Seoul, South Korea, with firebombs and demanded it be closed. Yesterday in Daegu, several hundred students hurled rocks and shattered windows at guard posts at the U.S. Cultural Center. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 41 points today to close at 2694.99. This is NPR News. An agreement to demobilize 11,000 Nicaraguan rebels based in Honduras was announced today by five Central American presidents. Honduran President José Ascona said the plan calls for the Contras to surrender their arms to a force of Spanish, West German, and Canadian soldiers. He said the agreement sets a 90-day timetable for demobilization and repatriation of the U.S.-supported Contras. West German embassy in East Berlin announced tonight it will close tomorrow to discourage East Germans from fleeing to the embassy. For the past 2 weeks, a growing number of East Germans have fled to the West Berlin embassies in Budapest, East Berlin, and Prague, seeking to emigrate to the West. Deidre Berger reports from Cologne.
Tonight, West Germany took the unprecedented step of shutting its East German embassy to defuse a growing crisis with East Berlin. The East German government today publicly warned its citizens of consequences if they flee into West German embassies. East Berlin says it alone has the right to decide on emigration applications. West German television tonight reported that 130 East Germans are in its East Berlin embassy, between 150 and 200 more are in the Budapest embassy, and about 30 are in Prague. Meanwhile, about 100 East Germans are expected to arrive in West Germany tonight from Austria, where they fled over the Hungarian-Austrian border. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
A Hungarian opposition group today criticized the Hungarian army for taking part in the 1968 Soviet-led invasion of Czechoslovakia. A statement issued by the Vas chapter of the Hungarian Democratic Forum said the Communist Party leadership at the time was mainly to blame for participation of the Hungarian army. American officials say the U.S. will urge Mexico to join in tougher joint action against drug traffickers by making money laundering an extraditable offense. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. Journalist William Shawcross writes, "A real picture of the world today would show millions of homeless men, women, and children being forced from north, south, east, and west, often with no clear destination in sight, with little hope of return. It's a phenomenon that is intolerable." That's from the introduction Shawcross wrote to the book Forced Out, The Agony of the Refugee in Our Time. Shawcross's coverage of refugees dates back to 1970, when he started covering the war in Vietnam for the Sunday Times of London. This eventually led to his 1979 book, Sideshow, Kissinger, Nixon, and the Destruction of Cambodia. About America's secret bombing of Cambodia, Shawcross wrote, "It was not a mistake, it was a crime." His next book, The Quality of Mercy, examined the international response to the genocide in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge. Last year, Shawcross completed his book, The Shah's Last Ride, an investigation into the exile of the Shah of Iran and his attempts to gain asylum from the countries he thought were his allies. William Shawcross describes refugees as the population of the Fourth World.
There are 14 million refugees in the world today, and they are really an unseen world in a way, and we pay far too little attention to them, but 14 million people is bigger than many, many countries in the United Nations, and these refugees have no representation at all.
You describe something that you've given the name of compassion fatigue. Describe what you mean by that.
It's a terrible sickness. It's a sort of modern sickness, rather like AIDS. It's caused, I think, by the speed and the plethora of modern communications. The fact that you can be in touch instantaneously with almost any part of the world and images of any part of the world can be beamed up and down to any other part of the world by satellite. And I think, for example, I would take the case of the Vietnamese boat people. In the late 1970s, when they first began to sail out of Vietnam, they aroused enormous sympathy and compassion. Now, 10 years later, Vietnamese boat people are still coming out of Vietnam, but they don't arouse any compassion at all. In fact, they arouse, if anything, impatience. And the world has moved on. Vietnam hasn't changed very much, and the problems which forced people to leave are similar today to those which they were 10 years ago. But the rest of the world has moved on, and we've been assaulted by other images, if you like, and other appeals to our conscience since the boat people began 10 years ago. One of the most notable ones, of course, is was the famine in Ethiopia in 84-85. Now there's a new famine in Sudan. There has been continual warfare and suffering in Central America. Those are just a few of the vast number of images that succeed each other showing suffering all over the world. And I think it is fatiguing, and I'm not surprised that people should feel compassion fatigue, but it is dangerous and it is, above all, destructive for those for whom we are trying to feel compassion, like, for example, the boat people whose fate today is much more uncertain than it was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. You wrote that we have to ask ourselves whether the brief attention given by international communities to some people in distress really alleviates their condition as much as it just assuages our consciences. Can you think of an example where you think that relief did more for the consciences of the people providing it than it did for the people it was provided to?
Well, one of the situations which I know a little bit about is that of the Cambodians, and the Cambodians were given a massive amount of relief supplies and food and financial assistance for famine relief in 1979-80. It did nothing, this relief, to help undo the real problems of the country, the real political problems, to help solve those problems. Indeed, a lot of the aid was diverted or was at least useful to the government's fighting over Cambodia and helped build up the forces on either side and helped build up the civil war, if you like, which has continued through the 10 years since then. And we gave all this money, and I'm not saying that we should not. This is one of the dilemmas about writing about these problems in the third world, because people turn around to you and say, well, if it all is diverted or if it all causes the problems that you say, then we should just turn our backs and do nothing, shouldn't we? And I don't think that that is the answer. But nonetheless, the compassion, if you like, of people in the West aroused by the Cambodian disaster in 1979 was effective in saving hundreds of thousands of lives. But at the same time, it enabled the Vietnamese government in Phnom Penh and the Cambodian resistance led by the communist Khmer Rouge, who were the mass murderers before, to rebuild their respective forces and to continue fighting, which they have done ever since.
So have you had to examine your conscience as a journalist and ask, am I doing more harm than good by exposing some of the ways that aid has at times been diverted to the wrong people?
Well, when I was writing The Quality of Mercy, which I find absolutely impossible to write and the most difficult book I've ever written for the very issues that we're talking about, a lot of aid officials from the United Nations and some of the smaller voluntary relief agencies were appalled. And if I showed them drafts of chapters for their comments, they said, you can't publish this. If you publish this, then next time there's a famine, no one will give any money. And then, Mr. Shawcross, the deaths of all those children will be on your conscience. And I found this a rather disagreeable and unpleasant threat. And I didn't think it was true, but it certainly perhaps made me deal with, and perhaps I was wrong, I was aware that relief agencies are not the same as governments. They are ostensibly seeking to do good, and perhaps one has to judge them by slightly different standards. But maybe I was wrong. Maybe I should have been much tougher on them. I don't know.
Let me quote you again. You've said that the real needs of a country are often obscured by propaganda, sensationalism, and cliché. It's the cliché part that I find the really interesting part of that equation. That's something that we don't really consider as much as propaganda and sensationalism. Would you address the subject of clichés and how harmful they can be?
Yes, well, one Oxfam official said to me, again, in the case of Cambodia, he said that when it finally became a cause célèbre in 1979, it had everything from our point of view in terms of fundraising, he said. He said it had beautiful brown people, brown, not black, he said. It had a Hitler figure, Pol Pot. It had lovely countryside and Buddhist temples and Buddhist monks in saffron roads. And he said basically it was like sex on a tiger skin. We couldn't go wrong.
A real made-for-TV movie kind of scenario.
Yes.
So this must mean that as a journalist, you try really hard to not come up with the clichés to make your case for what's going on in the world.
Well, I think one can use the clichés, but being aware of what it is and say, look, this is a cliché, but it also happens to be an accurate description of what mm-hmm. is happening. I think one has to be aware of it oneself and, if possible, point it out to one's readers or one's audience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You've described yourself as sometimes feeling like a tourist of the refugee world.
Yes. Well, this is right. And I mean, in Thailand, for example, I would drive out from Bangkok to the refugee camps and talk to refugees and then take down their testimony and then drive back to my hotel and have a nice dinner in Bangkok with friends and be extremely comfortable. And it's awful, and that those refugees were still stuck behind that barbed wire. This happens, of course, in all sorts of journalism. It's not fundamentally different, but I found it in terms of refugee life particularly depressing. And I suppose the most obvious, the most blatant example of it was in Ethiopia, where I flew one day with the RAF, which were dropping grain to starving peasants who had, in a very mountainous area, and they'd come from hundreds of miles, literally, to pick up grain, these Ethiopian peasants and farmers. And we landed on this little tiny airstrip with a plane that could land on a very short grassy strip, and waited for the airdrop to begin. And the all day long, RAF planes came in and dropped bags of grain from a height of about 10 feet as the planes went. They were just pushed out of the hold as the plane flew over the airstrip. And then the farmers would come rushing out from the side of the airstrip to pick up the bags of grain that had fallen. And many of them had burst. And there were these bags of grain burst all over the field and the rocks, and the farmers would sweep up the individual pieces of grain one by one with little twigs and bundle them into their sacks. And we were sitting on the side of the mountain all day, just 100 yards away, I suppose. The RAF people calling in the planes, a few relief workers, and I think another journalist and myself. And we had been told by the RAF, the Royal Air Force, to bring with us lunch boxes from our hotels in Addis Ababa, which we had done. And in Addis there was no starvation, because the government made sure that the urban population was perfectly well fed. And so we had these nice lunch boxes, cardboard boxes filled with chocolates and pieces of chicken and ham sandwiches and cakes and things like that, which was rather extraordinary. And the Royal Air Force people were sitting with their big canteens of tea and eating Mars bars. And there were these people sweeping up the grain, and one could give away one's lunchbox. But 2 hours later, we got back in our plane and flew back to Addis, and it was a very nice meal in the hotel, and I just thought of those people still only an hour away, but still just sweeping up individual pieces of grain.
So in the light of that, what did you do? Did you give away your lunchbox?
Yes, I kept. I think I kept one sandwich for myself, but I gave away most of it.
I want to talk with you more, but first let's take a short break. William Shawcross is my guest, and he's written the introduction for a new book called Forced Out, The Agony of the Refugee in Our Time. We'll talk more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is journalist William Shawcross. He began investigating the refugee situation in Southeast Asia after the Vietnam War as he researched his book Sideshow, Kissinger, Nixon, and the Destruction of Cambodia. It was about the secret bombing of Cambodia. Shawcross has written the introduction to the new book Forced Out, The Agony of the Refugee in Our Time. I should mention his latest book, The Shah's Last Ride, was about the exile of the Shah of Iran.
He was a rather well-placed refugee in the sense that he had a lot of money, but even he couldn't find anywhere to go with all that money.
Well, you think that the whole definition of refugee, by the way, should be changed, should be broadened, because the meaning of refugee has changed. The reason for refugees has changed.
It hasn't changed completely, and the original meaning, a refugee is someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution and has left his homeland thereby and wishes to seek asylum elsewhere. That is still an absolutely valid reason for thousands upon thousands of people, hundreds of thousands, I would say. But it is also true that refugees now, and this is not totally new, but many refugees are fleeing not just individual persecution, but war and violence. And they seem to me to be just as needy of asylum as anyone else, and I think that that they should be treated as refugees. And there is a tendency now, and this again is linked to the speed of communications and the shrinking of the world, there is a tendency on the part of governments to denounce refugees as mere economic migrants, people who just want to improve their economic conditions. Well, this is slightly odd that they should be denounced as such if one thinks that the entire philosophy of the Western world, if you like, is based upon the idea of self-improvement and capitalist advancement, if you wish, advancement, well, economic advancement within a capitalist context, and to dismiss those others from the rest of the world who have similar aspirations seems to me to be, to put it mildly, to be being a bit unfair. And again, it's very hard, I think, when you have You have the satellites obviously going both ways. You can be sitting in your living room watching live starving peasants dying in Ethiopia, and at the same time, other peasants in, say, the Philippines or Indonesia or Guatemala can be watching from the same satellites different transmissions of Dallas or Dynasty or advertisements for cars or Coca-Cola or whatever. And so the images go both ways. We see third world impoverishment and they see first world luxury. And it's not surprising that they would aspire to have some of that luxury. And it's not those advertisements and those images are meant to be enticing. And yet when they do entice people to come here or to come to Europe, we say, go to hell, get out of here.
You think prosperous countries need to re-examine the standards they use to admit refugees?
Yes, I think we do, absolutely. And in Europe, a terrible thing is happening now. In 1992, Europe is going to be a completely free and open market between the European countries. All the barriers for trade and commercial movement are coming down. But at the same time, barriers against refugees are going up. Our governments are trying to create a fortress in Europe to stop refugees coming in. And they're pretending that a huge, vast flood of people is beating at the gates of Europe, which is nonsense. Of the 14 million people who are refugees in the world today, 90% live in the poor countries of the third world. They've moved, for example, from Ethiopia to the Sudan or from El Salvador to Honduras. They're not coming into the prosperous first world. There are less than a million or so of those 14 million who are coming into the first world. And yet we are taking the most draconian measures to stop individuals getting in. And for example, there is now legislation in many European countries, including England, to punish airlines who bring in refugees. And this means that airline clerks all over the world are trying to screen passengers to determine whether they're refugees or not. Now, it's absurd for an airline clerk, a young man or woman, to have that responsibility to decide that someone should not be allowed to get on a plane, someone who has a valid ticket and probably may even have a visa, because he or she is a refugee or could be a refugee. And that's a grotesque procedure, but it's happening. And so a lot of people are being turned off planes because they're refugees. Others who get onto planes tear up their passports in the lavatory of the planes or tear up whatever papers they've managed to forge or scrounge and arrive at immigration desks in airports saying, I'm a refugee. And some of them are subjected to the most appalling behavior. In London and Heathrow, the behavior is pretty bad towards refugees. And in many other places, I'm sure it's worse. And there is a new category of refugee now called orbit cases. And these are refugees who have been refused entry into the first country into which they've flown and have been put back on the airplane on which they arrived. And the airline has shuffled them around the world to try and find other places that will take them. And these people can be flying for literally weeks at a time, going on and on and on, trying to find a home and not succeeding.
Your father was Britain's chief prosecutor for the Nuremberg trials?
Yes, that's right.
And I was wondering if when you were growing up around the supper table, if there were a lot of discussions about the kinds of issues we've been talking about today, about compassion and cruelty.
Well, I'm sure there were. And certainly Nuremberg was something of which I was very much aware in my childhood. And we had some of those old 78 RPM discs, records of the speeches at Nuremberg, which I listened to with a sort of rather awful, macabre fascination, I suppose, because they were so extraordinary, the recounting and the summing up speeches in particular of the prosecutors of the evils of the Nazi regime. And so I suppose that was something that I was aware of at a rather young age, the nature or the possibility of evil and the way in which it could be combated.
One of your best-known books is really about American policy, about the American secret bombing of Cambodia. And I'm curious about how you became involved as a British journalist writing about America.
Well, I don't know why someone else, an American, should have written that book. I'm sure could have done it much better. I was in Vietnam and briefly in Cambodia as a journalist for the Sunday Times in London. And then I was working in Washington in 1972-73 as a congressional fellow working in Capitol Hill. And I was just very much caught up, first of all, in Watergate and was very much aware of what was going on in Indochina. I went back in 74 and 75 and at the time of the fall of Saigon. And then in the end of 75, terrible stories began to come out of Cambodia about the brutality of the Khmer Rouge victors who had won the war in 75 and imposed the most vicious draconian regime upon the country, driving everyone out of the country, out of the cities, into the countryside, and imposing a very, very bloody form of Stalinist dictatorship. And I went to talk to refugees in Thailand about what was going on under the Khmer Rouge, and their stories seemed to me to be unbelievable but true. It seemed extraordinary that any regime would behave like this, but nonetheless, these people were not, it seemed to me, to be lying. So I came back and persuaded the Sunday Times to let me do a long investigation into what had happened in Cambodia in the last 10 years and how this group, the Khmer Rouge, had come to take power, who they were, and what had happened in the country. And I wrote this and then decided that I'd like to write a book about it.
I'm thinking about what an interesting situation it must be to be a journalist and find all these refugees who are telling you these harrowing stories that you figure must be true. On the other hand, they're unbelievable, and you have to document if they're true or not, what you were just describing.
Yes, it is difficult. And at that time, a lot of people, particularly on the left, did not wish to believe the horror stories of the Khmer Rouge. And they said, oh, this is just the bloodbath theory that American officials had been trotting out for years and years to justify the American presence in Indochina. It's CIA-inspired, and so on and so on. And there was a reluctance to believe that it was the case. But it seemed to me that, unbelievable though the stories sounded, the refugees were telling the truth. And so it turned out when finally people were allowed into Cambodia in 1979 and saw the mass graves of the victims of the Khmer Rouge, the piles of skulls, which we can all remember.
What was your reaction the first time you were shown a mass grave?
I thought very much about Nuremberg. And I that was in 1980, when I went to Cambodia after the Khmer Rouge had been overthrown by the Vietnamese and was taken straight from the airport by a guide from the foreign ministry to a site just outside Phnom Penh where they had just uncovered another mass grave, and all the bones were piled in different piles, the skulls in one pile and the leg bones in another, and arms. It was, and these people had been killed only a few months before, about 9-10 months before. And it was absolutely appalling, and the smell of decaying flesh was still all over the place. And it reminded me very much of the descriptions in some of my father's speeches in the Nuremberg prosecution about the mass graves that the Nazis had created, and people being herded into them and shot by SS troops. And I had never expected, and certainly had never wished, to see anything of the sort myself. And yet here it was, a similar outrage, which had been perpetrated only a few months ago, not 50, 40 years ago.
Are you working on another book now?
Yeah, I am. It's rather different, but it embraces some of the issues that we've been talking about. It's looking at the new global media empires, and whereas we've always had press barons like William Randolph Hearst in this country and others, we have never yet had global media barons. And now we do for the first time, and the most important of them is Rupert Murdoch, who was an Australian but is now an American citizen. And his media empire is the biggest and the most important of the global media empires, and I'm trying to look at this and see how it affects the way in which news and politics is conducted. And I don't quite know which direction the book will go, but that's what I'm trying to look at now, which is rather different from what I've been writing about in the past, but does, as I say, embrace some of the same issues of perception and communication.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
William Shawcross is the author of Sideshow, The Quality of Mercy, and The Shah's Last Ride. He wrote the introduction to the book Forced Out, The Agony of the Refugee in Our Time. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with musician George Clinton, from the soul group Parliament to the outrageously theatrical Funkadelic to the sci-fi of The Brides of Funkenstein. George Clinton took funk to the extreme. He's back with his first album in over 5 years, The Cinderella Theory. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Martha Plimpton is a beautiful, talented, teenaged actress, but despite all that, she's managed to avoid playing a succession of prom queens in a succession of teen movies. Coming up, we meet Martha Plimpton, the co-star of Parenthood. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of Ella Fitzgerald's 1961 album, Clap Hands, Here Comes Charlie. It's a collection of jazz and pop standards, novelty numbers, and torch songs. And television critic David Bianculli looks ahead to the fall season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. An intelligence report released today says the man shown dangling from the gallows in a videotape released last week by Muslim extremists is U.S. Marine Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins. Sources say the report does not draw any conclusions as to when Higgins died. A group calling itself the Organization of the Oppressed on Earth said it killed Higgins last Monday when a deadline passed for Israel to release a Muslim cleric kidnapped a few days earlier by Israeli commandos. A senior Iranian official at odds with Iran's offer to help with the foreign hostages called for a holy crusade against the U.S. today. Iran radio broadcast the remarks made at the gravesite of the late Ayatollah Khomeini. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
The speech today by Ali Akbar Montashami, Iran's interior minister, is the second time in as many days that he's challenged Hashemi Rafsanjani, Iran's new president. Yesterday, Montashami questioned Rafsanjani's right to assume the presidency until October 9th, a technical point, but made publicly. Today, Montashami warned that negotiations with the U.S. would weaken Iran's revolution. Montashami belongs to the radical faction within Iran. He's also the patron of Hezbollah, the group believed to be holding foreign hostages in Lebanon. His remarks followed Rafsanjani's pledge on Friday to help with the hostage crisis. Montashami's comments were broadcast on Tehran radio. Iranian broadcast is headed by a brother of the president, Hashemi Rafsanjani. It's unclear why there was a broadcast of comments at odds with Rafsanjani's more moderate position. In London, this is Deborah Amos.
President Bush today paid tribute to Lieutenant Colonel Higgins as the symbol of the courage of American servicemen. The president was speaking at a ceremony at Fort Myers in Arlington, Virginia, marking the 200th anniversary of the founding of the War Department. Later, the president spoke to the Boy Scouts at their 12th annual National Jamboree in Bowling Green, Virginia. He called on the Scouts to look to the stars in the future. Scott Hoganson reports.
During his address to more than 30,000 people at the Jamboree, President Bush applauded the Scouts for what he called its leadership role in preparing future generations for space exploration. Citing the accomplishments of former Boy Scouts who later became astronauts, Bush said the next challenge in space lies in colonization.
The first spacefarers were unique. The lucky few, but your generation will have a broader, greater opportunity to live in space, to travel, to establish an outpost on the moon and explore the mysteries of Mars.
Bush also urged the Scouts to continue their work against drugs and says reported declines in drug use in the United States are a tribute to scouting. For National Public Radio, this is Scott Hoganson with the president in Bowling Green, Virginia.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 41.54 points to 2694.99. Advances led declines. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Ella Fitzgerald has been one of the best-known, most widely respected, and most imitated jazz singers for the past 50 years. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new Fitzgerald reissue.
I push the first valve down, the music goes down and around, whoa, 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 when it comes up here. I push the middle valve down, the music goes down around, below, 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 dee-dee-o. Listen to the jazz come out. I push the other valve down, the music goes round and around, whoa, 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 and it comes out here.
Ella Fitzgerald's Memorex commercials aside, she may be best known for her songbook recordings. Anthologies of classics by Cole Porter, Harold Arlen, Irving Berlin, or George and Ira Gershwin. But Fitzgerald isn't always so highbrow. Her first hit with Chick Webb's band in 1938 was the nursery rhyme A Tisket a Tasket. In many ways, it's easier to sing great material than it is to sing lightweight stuff.
Clap hands, here comes Charlie. Clap hands, good time, Charlie. Clap hands, here comes Charlie now. This way, meet the dollies. I say Ziegfeld Follies. Hey, Charlie, take a bow. See the smile on all those hungry faces. They can tell that he's a buyer from those wide and open spaces. Clap hands, here comes Charlie. Clap hands, good time, Charlie. Clap hands, here comes Charlie now.
Fitzgerald's 1961 album, Clap Hands, Here Comes Charlie, has just been reissued as a CD on the Verve label. It's an amiable mix of jazz and pop standards, novelty numbers, and maudlin torch songs. Fitzgerald does justice to ballads like My Reverie and Signing Off and the bebop anthem Night in Tunisia. But the oddball stuff really grabs me. For instance, she sings the only lyric to celebrate the cutting-edge sophistication of Jersey City, New Jersey, the home of Journal Square.
They call it that Jersey bounce, a rhythm that really counts. The temperature always mounts wherever they play the funny rhythm they play. It started on Journal Square, and somebody heard it there. He put it right on the air, and now you hear it everywhere. Uptown gave it new licks, downtown added some tricks. No town makes it sound the same as where it came from. So if you don't feel so hot, go out to some Jersey spot. And whether you're hip or not, the Jersey bounce will make you swing. Ooty-dooty, ooty-dooty, ooty. How I love that Jersey bounce. Oh, come on and play that Jersey bounce.
Ella Fitzgerald is rightly famous as an improvising scat singer. She didn't shatter all those wine glasses doing ballads. But she's also a better interpreter of lyrics than she's sometimes given credit for. Fitzgerald's sense of humor gives her an edge with silly songs, but she also knows how to sing an awkward lyric straight, especially when it's fitted to a graceful melody.
College boys are writing sonnets in the tender passion there. But I'm on the shelf with last year's Easter bonnets. Spring can really hang you up the most.
Anyone who can finesse those sentiments can breeze through Cry Me a River, that early 50s hit for Hollywood's deadpan chanteuse Julie London. Its lyric answers the old question, what rhymes with plebeian?
You drove me, nearly drove me out of my head. Why, you never shed a tear. I remember all that you said. Told me love was too plebeian. Told me you were through with me, and now you say you love me. Well, just to prove you do, come on and cry me a river. Cry me a river, 'cause I cry a river over you.
We lovers of pop culture are often accused of not being able to tell the bad from the good. Actually, what happens is, after studying pop for a while, you come to realize that what you've been told is bad really is good. Any movie fan sold on the weepy melodramas of director Douglas Sirk knows that. So does any reader hooked on the psychotic realism of crime novelist Jim Thompson. That sort of egalitarian talk freezes the blood of folks who promote great books programs and Eurocentric cultural literacy. But then it seems to me that such folks, not coincidentally, are rarely big jazz fans. I ask you, would you want to do without stuff like The Music Goes Round and Around or Cry Me a River? Me neither.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the Verve reissue of Ella Fitzgerald's Clap Hands, Here Comes Charlie.
The mood is the same, moon above you, aglow with its cool evening light, but shining at night in Tunisia, never does it shine so bright. The stars are aglow in the heavens, but only the wise understand.
This is Fresh Air. In Ron Howard's new film Parenthood, Martha Plimpton plays the teenage daughter of Diane Wiest. Plimpton has appeared in Woody Allen's Another Woman, Peter Weir's The Mosquito Coast, and Sidney Lumet's Running on Empty. She grew up in show business. Her father is the film actor Keith Carradine, and her mother Shelley Plimpton acted on the New York stage. Martha Plimpton made her first film when she was 12. I told her that each time I've seen her, I've been struck by her screen presence and the authority conveyed in her voice.
I think part of it has to do with the fact that the first few jobs that I did get when I was younger were on the stage. And of course, you know, voice and enunciation, those are all very important things. And those are things I had to learn fairly early on. And I also just had a lot of experience just playing with myself in front of the mirror as far as playing with my voice and my attitudes and my body when I was little, you know. I think that has something to do with it.
Something else I find really outstanding about you is your beauty, and I think it's a very individual beauty. It's not your standard issue good looks where the face becomes interchangeable with 1,000 other faces.
Well, thank you. That's really nice.
I was wondering if your beauty has ever gone unnoticed by some casting directors because it wasn't the standard issue kind.
Well, I think probably so, although I've never been actually told. I think it is a major concern for a lot of actresses that they look okay and that they fit into the mold of whatever, you know. I obviously, that hasn't really stuck to me, and I'm pretty lucky about that, I guess.
You haven't made a career in quote, teen films, and I'm wondering if you've consciously stayed away from them or whether they were uninterested in you.
I think a little bit of both, actually. I kind of avoided them, you know, the ones of a lower caliber simply for obvious reasons because of the fact that I wanted to do things with integrity, you know.
What kind of teenage stereotypes really drive you crazy when you see them in a script?
There's really only one kind, and that's just the teenage stereotype, the basic, you know, the girl with the, you know, with the prom or who's really good looking, who has the boyfriend, or the girl who's really sweet and really smart and can't get, I mean, they all seem to have the same personalities, you know, wherever I go and whatever I see, you know, they all look the same. They're all the same people, you know, from one movie to the next. And, you know, that's what was nice about Say Anything was that it was different. And that's also what was nice about Running on Empty was that you saw people in a, saw young people in a realistic situation that involved something other than just a prom or, you know, a lipstick shade, you know, and I thought that was nice.
Your parents are both actors, and
yeah.
Your parents never married. How old were you when they separated?
I was not born yet when my parents separated.
Hmm. The Carradine family is one of, like, the great American acting families. Did you feel very connected to that family since you were living with your mother and your father was on the other coast?
Sure. I feel connected in a lot of ways. I mean, I have always had a communication with them throughout the years, and with my grandfather, I had a pretty good relationship with him. And although I rarely saw them, our time together was pretty well concentrated because we all had something in common. You have to keep in mind that my uncles and my father both are there constantly working. I mean, they're never anywhere I can find them, really. I mean, it's really hard to find them. I mean, my dad's like in Yugoslavia right now somewhere, you know, Budapest or something.
Did you ever find yourself going to the movies to try to learn more about your father, see him in his latest role?
No, I didn't. If I wanted to learn about my father, I called him up, or I went to see him, or I wrote him a letter. But I have to say that I have not been the most comprehensive daughter as far as seeing all of his films. I really haven't.
Why not?
Seen all of his work. Simply because, let's put it this way, that most of the movies that he's done, either while I was growing up, were rated R. Couldn't go see those, you know, although Nashville I saw. I don't know. It just seems to have worked out that way. I don't think he's seen all of my work either. I just think that, I don't know if it really matters all that much for us to keep up on each other's career strides, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, your mother is an actress, and she was, what, in the Broadway production of Hair?
She was in the original and the Broadway productions of Hair. She was in it for, like, some unbelievable amount of time. I don't even know, like, 8 or 9 years or something.
Uh-huh.
You know, I basically was around the stage and the theater from ever since I can remember.
Now, I've read about you that you and your mother didn't have much money when you were young.
Yeah.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, basically means that basically my mother was, you know, a 23-year-old actress living in New York City when she had me. And there's not a lot of income for an actress in the theater and off Broadway in New York City, and you know, with a daughter living alone, basically it was a struggle.
How old were you when you started acting?
I was 8 years old when I got my first job. I mean, I worked at the Public Theater for Elizabeth Suedos in New York. You know, the Joe Papp's Theater downtown. And then I kind of moved on from there.
When you're that young, when you're 8 years old, do you relate to acting at all as an art, or is it a way of pleasing adults?
Maybe in some deep psychological way that's true. I mean, what I basically noticed when I was 8 was that I had fun doing it, and that it was really fun to show off and to, you know, play around and play act. And that was something that I really enjoyed and got into. And that's pretty much what I noticed. I mean, I didn't really look at acting as an art. I mean, I didn't even really consider it acting. I just considered it, you know, play acting, having fun.
Do you grow up quickly when you're working around adults as a professional?
Well, I think in a way you do. In a way you have to, because you have to be responsible and professional, and you can't keep people waiting, and you can't, you know, play around on the set, and, you know, you got to really do the work and do the job. And that's something that takes a lot of concentration. And, you know, sometimes you get yelled at for being too loud or something. I mean, it happens all the time with kids. And I don't know. I don't think I grew up too fast. I just think that I was raised with a very strong sense of professionalism, you know, and responsibility, and the difference between reality and acting and the job and doing the job correctly. And so I wouldn't say that I grew up too fast. I just knew I knew the order of things in my life. You know, I knew what was acting, I knew what was play, and I knew what was job time, you know.
I think everybody goes through a period around puberty when they're very uncomfortable with themselves physically. Maybe their skin is breaking out and their body's mm-hmm. changing. They feel very awkward. You were probably on camera during some of that. Was that an awkward time for you?
Well, I think I you know, everybody goes through their awkward time. I think I went through my awkward time pretty early. I mean, I'd say I went through it around, you know, 11, 12, 13 to about 15, I guess, 15 or 16. I never really had acne. I mean, I had my pimple problems like everybody does. I never really had it bad, and I never had any sort of, I mean, I did have my little, when I was 12, you know, and I, you know, became a woman, as it were, you know, got my first, you know, period, basically. I gained a lot of weight, and, you know, got kind of pudgy, but I never really was uncomfortable, like mortally uncomfortable with my appearance or my, you know, whatever. I guess basically because I wasn't all that concerned with it at the time.
In the film Running on Empty, you were cast opposite River Phoenix, and I believe you were a couple then, and I frankly have no idea if you still are or not, but I was wondering if that's an experience you'd want to repeat, playing opposite someone on screen who you actually had a relationship with off screen.
I don't think there's anything wrong with it. We were great friends at the time and still are great friends, and I love working with River. I think he's a real professional, and he really is a fine actor, and I respect him a great deal. Really, it's up to the individual. I mean, a lot of people say that it's hard for them because they can't seem to, you know, forego the reality, you know, that's there. And I don't know, we didn't have trouble with it at all, and I think it was probably because we have, I don't know, our concentration, our level of concentration and the way that we work is slightly similar in some ways. I think that it was pretty easy. It was nice, too, working with a friend.
Is there a kind of part you would like to get in the near future?
Oh, gosh. You know, finding a role, just a role in general for a young woman is so hard already that I just like to find something, you know, different than, you know, the norm. I mean, basically, you know, there's only so many daughters and girlfriends, you know, precocious teenagers that one can play without really just becoming extremely bored and, you know, ready to move on. I just like to see a script, you know, with some real dialogue in it, with some actual words that people say, you know. It's so rare to find that. You know, I'm basically a beggar for a decent part right now, so I can't really be a chooser yet. But as soon as those parts come around and as soon as Hollywood changes its attitudes towards women, I'm sure that I'll have plenty of ideas.
Martha Plimpton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Martha Plimpton co-stars in the new film Parenthood. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to hear a special report this evening from NPR's reporter Phyllis Crockett about the disappearing young black men, by which Phyllis means the demographic hole, really, in this country among young blacks. The mortality rate is so high now for black men that many in the black community now speak of a lost generation between homicide, death, and imprisonment. Also, we'll have the news, including the word from the Pentagon that experts have now concluded the man in the video released last week was William Higgins and that he's dead.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. TV critic David Bianculli recently got a preview of what we're in store for this fall season. He attended the TV press tour in Los Angeles, at which all the broadcast and cable networks unveil their new shows. David, are we in for a good season?
I don't know. I don't think so. But we're not in for like one of the all-time worst, but it's a pretty bland season because of all the advertising scares and everything that happened and people not wanting to take risks with programming or with content.
Are there specific programs that were hit hard by pressure groups, and is that getting reflected now in specific programs?
Yeah, they were targeted. Married with Children on Fox is the most famous example because of the housewife, Terry Ricolta. And so in this fall, there aren't going to be the sort of outrageous content programs that Married with Children has. But the irony here is that Married with Children has more than doubled its audience since this flap happened. So I think that either at mid-season or next year, we may see the pendulum swing back again and people go for the ratings rather than the sensibility.
What are some of the new shows?
Well, it's like you have big stars. You have Richard Chamberlain in a weekly series playing a doctor. You
That's remarkable.
Yeah, I know. He hasn't done that in 20-some years. You have Jackie Mason playing a Jewish comedian in Chicken Soup. You have Lindsay Wagner playing a zookeeper in Peaceable Kingdom. The best shows, I think, to look for are The Famous Teddy Z, which comes from Hugh Wilson, who did WKRP in Frank's Place, and then Life Goes On, which is a family-type drama about a family. One of the children is autistic, but it's not maudlin, and even though I cringed at the subject matter from the description because I didn't think it could be done right, the show does it very well.
What's the Jackie Mason program about, Chicken Soup?
Chicken Soup, he lives with his mother. Lynn Redgrave is his next-door neighbor, and they're going to be romantically involved. The alleged humor here is that she's Catholic, he's Jewish, and it's sort of like Bridget Loves Bernie, except for real.
And The Famous Teddy Z, that's one created by the same people as Frank's Place and,
right.
and KRP in Cincinnati.
Yeah,
what's the storyline?
The storyline here is that this is based on an actual incident. You may be able to fill in the names here, but I really can't. It's about a young guy who was just in the mailroom of a like William Morris-type agency and was sent on an errand to bring a big star, who in reality was Marlon Brando, back from the airport. And by the time he got back, they'd gotten in a fight. Marlon Brando loved him and signed him on as his agent. So here's this kid with no experience who all of a sudden is one of the big players in Hollywood. And Hugh Wilson hates Hollywood so much that it ought to make for a fun series.
Did you get a sense that the new season is going to be dominated by the broadcast networks, or are the independents like Fox and the cable stations really catching up in terms of the viewers that they're reaching?
They really are catching up. As a matter of fact, Fox is beating the networks this summer in certain rating spots, and so the networks can't deny their presence anymore, and they're all being aggressive. But to react, instead of making better programs, they're promoting their promotions. I mean, NBC and CBS are making deals with Kmart and making deals with Sears, and you're going to see all these ads, and they're promoting their ads, not their programs. We've had people tell us about their ads.
So to sum up, a bland season?
Well, a safe season, but there's always mid-season. I mean, a lot of the best shows of the last few years have come up, you know, they've held and seen what works, and then when most stuff doesn't work, that's when we got the Wonder Years and things like that. So I hate to dismiss a whole season just based on being sort of bored early.
What's the show you're going to miss most that's getting replaced by something you don't like?
Frank's Place. I really, really loved Frank's Place. And, stuff like Mission Impossible comes back and Frank's Place doesn't. This is not a world I want to live in all the time.
Oh, well. David Bianculli, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
David Bianculli writes about television for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, Audrey Voblaitis, and Dan Lachlan. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, One Nation Under a Groove, we meet funk master George Clinton. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the 60s soul group The Jive Five. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.